Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. Back on tour up in Edinburgh, still on Monday morning. A city which is partying like it's 1896. Penny farthings out just in the road outside of us. You can probably hear her on tour because there's a bit of clattering about in our hotel, but hopefully that will all sound all good. But yeah, 1896, the last time Scotland won four championship Calcutta matches in a row over England. Fully deserved. So to talk through all of it with us, the two regulars. First, Mark Palmer, our Scottish correspondent, is here. How good to be covering the moral Grand Slam, Mark?
Yes, indeed. It was strangely straightforward, I felt, on Saturday. I actually felt comfortable, which is a very odd feeling. But after the high drama of those first two games against Wales and France, it was very, all very flat in places, actually.
Ah, there you go. Well, also alongside us, having penned his Groundhog Day, England have lost on Sunday for Monday piece, is rugby correspondent Alex Lowe.
Yeah, hello guys. There was a very familiar feeling waking up on Sunday morning thinking, right, let's pick through the bones of another Calcutta Cup defeat, another Six Nations defeat, which is not, even as a neutral observer, it's not the fun part of the job. I had hoped that, Mark and I are sitting here kind of covering different teams, but as an England guy predominantly covering England, I sort of hoped that we'd wake up on Sunday having seen England win so that we could kind of give some validation to a lot of what we'd seen before. I think after England's first two games, we said we need the context of the Calcutta Cup match in order to judge whether England were the real deal or becoming something. And it was just another step backwards. Really, I mean, we'll get into it, but like amateurish at times, like ugly and error-strewn and careless, and brain dead at times as well. So, yeah, we're back in the loop of England play, England lose.
Yeah, but we've had a good time in Edinburgh, haven't we?
We have had a great time in Edinburgh.
Thank you, Mark, for putting that on for us.
It's been class.
Of course. My pleasure as always.
Well, it was Courtney on our pod that everyone would have last listened to last Thursday, Wednesday, who was saying, oh, mate, it always rains when I come up here. And it hasn't rained once, has it?
It's been lovely. It was supposed to rain and it didn't. It's been great.
Spring-like almost.
Well, yeah. It's Scotland who now play all the rugby. They don't want it to be raining.
That's it. We don't want wet
days. Gone are the days of Duncan Hodge and the boys in a bog.
Get that roof open.
Yeah, exactly. So look, everyone, as we're up in Scotland, we're going to focus pretty heavily on their win over England, obviously. But we'll also get into that absolutely absurd 13-all draw between France and Italy and touch on Ireland, who are obviously 3-for-3 after their win against Wales, and then do our usual God or Goddess nominations. But first, why don't we get into our analysis of the Calcutta Cup after this? Right, okay, so Scotland 30, England 21. First time, actually, England has scored 20 points for a long time up in Scotland, but didn't matter. Anyway.
It doesn't matter when you give the opposition 31 points.
So, Mark, let's start with Scotland, because they won. We joked at the top about the moral Grand Slam, but look, Scotland are a properly good team now, aren't they? Do you still think they don't get credit for how good they are these days?
Possibly, although I think, that may only come in the films of time if they take that next step of genuinely competing for a title. And I suppose that's the beauty of what where they are now, that even despite the disappointment of that French finale, they are now going into rounds 4 and 5 with something substantial to play for, be it only in inverted commas a triple crown, but potentially a championship if things fall into place. So they're on the cusp of taking a step which has so far proved elusive, and maybe that's when the real fullness of the praise will come.
We joked earlier about Scotland loving the good weather because they play all the rugby, but they didn't need to on Saturday. And what struck me was we were sitting in front of the Scotland coaching box, and there were moments where even they were shouting to Finn to move it, and he was just like, no, I'm going to kick it in behind England, keep them running at us because they keep giving us the ball back. Like, it was a smart game plan.
I think so, and I think that performance probably summed up Finn's increasing maturity, a lot of which I think I probably put down to, you know, what he's doing in the Premiership. That ability to control a game now is right up there with his ability to pull something out of his backside, which he's been famous for down the years. So, yeah, a very mature display from him. And then, you know, in Van der Merwe, you've just got a match winner of the calibre that England are lacking at the moment. Somebody just come up with not just one, but three decisive moments in the course of a game, and that was the difference between two, you know, I'm not going to say evenly matched sides, because I think Scotland were comfortably better, but, you know, Scotland were pretty error-strewn, certainly in that first quarter as well, but because, you know, they were feeding off those English errors, and you'd have to say prompting them as well with some really good aggressive defence, but they probably didn't have to play as well as they would have expected to win the game.
I think the intelligence side of it really shone out to me. Like, couple of quick kickoffs that Finn took to catch England unawares, and both of them worked. One landed on George Furbank, who skewed his kick out. England managed to get the ball back, and then Danny Kerr kicked it out on the full. And you're like, that's a net win for Scotland from just a quick thinking from Finn. And then second half, he did the same, isolated George Martin, who you would still have expected to have caught it, but he caught him unawares. Mm. And that sort of streetwise in-game thinking was really evident, I thought, with Scotland, and completely absent with England, to the point where Steve Borthwick afterwards was like bemused as to why they weren't correcting what they were doing. And then you into the last 5-10 minutes and they're lining up, they're taking 20 seconds to get the ball out, and you're like, where's the urgency? Where's the thought process here?
Can I ask you about Doohan? Like, you've covered a lot of Scotland over a long time. What, that second finish, maybe, is that better than the Twickenham one, or is the Twickenham one ahead of that?
Well, we actually asked him this after the game.
Yeah, okay, what did he say?
And he inevitably found it impossible to separate the two. They're just two bloody good moments, I think, were his phrase. But they just, you know, I think as I wrote my piece today, that somebody that big shouldn't be able to move so quick. It's almost unfair that he has.
Remarkable pace, wasn't it?
Yeah, and you know, and once that a human of that size builds up a head of steam, there's no stopping him. I mean, Ben Earl was left for dead, and then they didn't lay a glove on him. Nobody got near him. So just a sensational, natural finisher.
And like a lot of people, because, well, you can find any opinion you'd like on X or Twitter or whatever you want to call it, and a fair few people are making the obvious point of, he's not really Scottish, is he? Which is something that Craig Chalmers mentioned in your piece the other day, of there's only one real Scottish accent in the team. And it's an issue that kind of follows around Scotland. But if we were to flip it, because I don't want to go down that route of all the spring jocks and all that, but is this an example of Scotland making the most out of what they've got, or and where England are not? And I'm not saying that's poaching players from all over the place, but in terms of they don't have a huge grassroots system, they don't have all these millions of players coming through, they keep messing about with what is happening underneath the national team, don't they? But by hook or by crook, they get a good team out on the pitch these days.
Yeah, and I think, you know, with Van der Merwe, the point to make is that, you know, in terms of so-called project players, he was nothing of the sort. He came over as a signing for Edinburgh in 2017, having had a really miserable first spell in Europe with Montpellier, barely played, came over with a hip injury that actually saw him fail his medical, and dear old Cocker's thankfully pushed through the deal regardless, which I'm sure he might be regretting now in his quieter moments with his England hat on. But, you know, he then has made a life for himself here. That he had that spell in Worcester, of course, but he wouldn't doubt his commitment to the cause for a single second. And I think, you know, just the way he plays and the sort of the sterling contributions and important contributions he's made in so many high profile fixtures, he's been taken to the hearts of Scotland fans, and just no issue there.
Craig's wider point, although he made that comment about one Scottish accent, which is kind of provocative and not actually accurate. But his wider point was around project players and what's happened in the past as being a shortcut, because instead of investing time and energy and resources into the system, they've just filled gaps with overseas players. That was his biggest issue. And what I asked him, and I'd be interested to know your thoughts, Wales had great success under Gatland in his first spell, which was despite what was below. Now, Scotland haven't quite taken that next step, but it does feel that this team, and as Will says, what Gregor's managing to get out of the players available is almost in spite of what's sitting below it. And how aware are the SRU of having to bridge that gap and make sure that their under-20s team get back into the top competition and the player pathway is improved?
Absolutely, and I think hopefully they're very aware about it, because we write about it every week. but there is a separate issue there, as you say, between, you know, the issue of project players. Scotland has always been a country that's had to top up its homegrown resources, be it from England and now further afield in the modern era. It's always going to be a small player base. But for me, you know, that's a legitimate strategy, absolutely. But only if you are also doing absolutely everything you can to nurture your own domestic pathway, so that's the icing on the cake and not the core ingredient of the cake. And I think, you know, that balance has definitely become skewed in the last 5 to 10 years. We've had any number of different people come in and, you know, launch strategies, and this is how we're going to turn it around. There's yet another one being put in place at the moment, which involves the throwing out of Super 6 or Super Series as it is now, which was going to be the big bridge between the amateur and professional games. So a lot of work required in that area. But, you know, I think it was Gregor himself who pointed out at the end of last year's Six Nations that in the previous 4 years, I think, of the under-20s team, not a single player had progressed into playing regularly in the pro ranks, you know, and that's just not sustainable, especially, you know, when we've only got two teams to populate to begin with. So, you know, definitely a lot of work required on that side.
And the realities of it, which was quite funny from Gregor in some ways. So after the game, Scotland have won their fourth Calcutta Cup in a row, all celebrations, and he comes in and goes, oh, by the way, we only had two training sessions with Finn and Ben White because of the regs. Especially the English players had to go back to England in the fallow week, and they will have to go back to England this fallow week coming up. And you ask Premiership Rugby people about it and Premiership Rugby fans, and they say, well, put your hand in your pocket and pay the compensation. But it does seem a ludicrous thing, doesn't it, that there aren't even any games. That this regulation has been in place for ages, but this year there aren't any matches for them to go back to, or even any training, Mark.
Well, that's true. You know, and that's, Gregor clearly felt the need to get that off his chest, because he launched into that rant, in inverted commas, completely unprompted on Saturday night. So it was something he wanted to come and deliver. A limited amount of sympathy for that exact point you've just made, that, you know, there are no games. Bath, we know where Finn Russell's going to be going back to, and Cam Redpath, they're not even training this week. The players are on a week off. Is anybody really served by a situation where Finn is sitting in his house there rather than up here spending time with his family, a couple of training sessions to prepare for Italy? However, those regulations are there in black and white. You know, you can have them for 5 weeks of the 7 week period. That will hopefully change in 2026 with the global calendar. But, you know, is that a case of that to put up or pay up?
Is Simon Massey-Taylor going to Bath this week to knock on Finn's door to make sure he's in?
We were having this exact conversation before you got in your bed.
One of those little post-office notes, like, we tried your door and you weren't there.
Yeah, it's like, oh, what the... Has anyone tried this room in Scotland?
But there have been fines, haven't there? So yeah. 2013, it was actually October. It was a November series match, wasn't it? The Wales always play outside the calendar, and George North went and played for Wales against Australia when he shouldn't have done, and Northampton got fined $60,000. So there are financial punishments there if they do play silly buggers, I suppose.
There are, and there's also, you know, if you're Bath and paying Finn Russell the thick end of £1 million a year, you know, you will say, if we want to pay him £1 million a year to sit in his house for a week, you bloody well will, you know? Yeah. So, yeah. You know, I think you have to be cognizant of their prerogative as well.
So to just bring it back to sort of the realities of the Six Nations and the matches itself, as you said, Scotland have never been in the mixer on the final day of a Six Nations. Obviously, they won the Five Nations, as we well know, 99, the last one. So does that hamper them at all, that they don't have some of their players? Or because they're so well-grooved now, they probably can just slot in, guys like Finn and Ben White?
Yeah, I think more the latter. And, you know, there's still, for all that some of the sort of XL guys naturally steal the headlines, the core of the team is still very much that Edinburgh and Glasgow core. So they're available. They'll be in training this week. So I really don't think that Scotland's chances of winning in Rome particularly are hampered by not having, you know, Finn here for two training sessions this week. So I think it's possible to overstate that while also, you know, agreeing that Gregor does have a point in a wider sense.
Yeah. So look, everyone, I'm looking at my dial here. Now, we've done 10 minutes on Scotland. That's really good of us, isn't it? Because England have lost the match, and you would have expected, listener, that we would have gone straight in in England. But we haven't. But now we will.
Yeah, I'm interested to know what Mark thinks of watching England. Like, you're covering the glory years of Scotland in the Calcutta Cup. What were you expecting of England on Saturday, and what did you make of what you saw?
I find them such a difficult team to get a read on, and you know, as I was saying that to Will earlier, and you know, he said, "Well, try cover them for the last 4 years because we feel we've been writing the exact same thing for yeah, 4 years." And you think, it does still feel like that you know, sometimes you see them, think you can see a progression route where things are growing under Borthwick from World Cup to Six Nations, and yet that was just so error-ridden, so kind of bereft of, you know, they came out and tried and play some rugby. They did, you know, the first quarter and were successful in that. But almost a byproduct of that were the errors as well, that then, they, you know, it just became a real mess and difficult to actually see again what they were trying to do, never mind being able to pull it off. So I was pretty underwhelmed, I must say.
Yeah, I think there are two ways of, we were talking about this last night, two ways of sort of assessing Steve Borthwick's regime, if you like. I think those of us who are writing about it every day are probably more inclined to look at last year as a standalone project and just get as far as they can in the World Cup. And they made hard work of a pretty soft draw, but they got there and they finished third. And then to look at this year as a start of something new. But my sense is, and it was certainly the feeling on the tram leaving Murrayfield, that England fans don't look at it that minutely. They just look at their team and look at a team that they keep being told is building and building and building. And as the lady who spoke to us on the tram said, they've been building for 5 years. It's like, when are they going to get anywhere? And I think that's one of the challenges that Borthwick has that maybe Gatland with Wales doesn't have, because it's the PVAC era ended and it's like he started again when he's got rid of a whole... Borthwick's tried to straddle eras a bit with keeping some experience because he knows he needs to win now because it's England and the expectations upon them. But he carries a baggage of the previous era and a frustration and an impatience of England fans who want to see a product on the field. They want to see performances and wins.
Yeah.
You know, England have 2 from 5 3 years in a row, and it's maybe only the kind of unravelling of the French that might give them hope of bettering that this year.
Well, I suppose the Gatland point too is that if Borthwick came in with the Eddie baggage, Gatland's coming in with his own positive baggage of all those Grand Slams and titles from before. So the fact, we'll get onto them in a bit, but the fact that they're 0 from 3, everyone goes, well, hang on, Gatty's got a plan.
He'll build. The expectation's different in a positive way. I like I said at the outset, I was really disappointed in England because what I not expected to see, although I did think that they'd edge it because I was perhaps allowed myself to believe that the positive elements that they're working on were going to, there'd be another stride forward. And it just didn't happen. Like that, the first 20, they controlled the game and they were 10-0 up. But without the errors, they'd have been 17-0 up. And they needed to maximise that period. But they would, even that period, which feels like they played really well, there were passes to the floor, misdirected passes, passes to the head. When Xander Fagerson had to go off for the HIA, that was a chance for England to attack Scotland's scrum, and they gave away two stupid free kicks, and just allowed
overleaning.
You know, that,
yeah,
all of those errors in that first 20. By the end of it, they were still 10-0 up, and then they opened the back door, and Scotland went and ransacked it, and it's just, you know, it's a step backwards. And it's a real problem because I think the fans are just frustrated and impatient. And yet, it's very obvious that the end game of this team is a long way off.
So my feeling when Steve Borthwick and some of the players came to speak to us in the mix zone afterwards was they were all a bit stunned as well. And they didn't really... And like, it's quite soon after the match. So it's now Monday morning for us recording here. They'll probably have some more answers and would have watched it back loads, like we have. But they sort of couldn't really believe it, and they were just sitting there dumbstruck and going, I just don't know why we can't catch and pass. And there's been a lot of talk from Steve Borthwick about cohesion and looking enviously at the other teams and going, well, look at their cohesion and look at their cohesion. And some of that you can go, okay, fine. It was a back line that hadn't played together. But you go, Danny Kerr, 99 caps. George Ford, 94 caps. Henry Slade, 60 caps. Elliot Daly, 67 caps. Ollie Lawrence has played with Slade a few times before. You can't tell me those guys cannot catch and pass. No, like, it's just so strange.
Weirdly, the timing was off. Ford to Furbank, there were two drops in 2 minutes. The second one, which led to Duan's try. Ford to Lawrence a couple of times. It was Slade to Earl a couple of times. Oh, they've played together. It was just everything was a beat off working. And it was interesting that the live reaction from coach and players was, well, the first 20 minutes was what we wanted. And then we stopped, then we went off the game plan. And I actually wonder whether when they look back on it like I did yesterday, that first 20 minutes was largely what they wanted in terms of the control that they could bring to the game. But the error, the warning signs were already there. Yeah, the errors were already there. And what happened was when they didn't have the control, the errors continued and it just compounded itself. And I think what Borthwick said about, I want to understand what shifted from the first 20 to the second 20, was simply that the scoreboard changed. Because Scotland scored that brilliant try and then the counter try off the knock on, and suddenly England are not getting the control they want, but they're still trying to play, and they almost weren't building phases in the way they had been trying to, and then they couldn't get a foothold in the game, and then Finn was just smart, you know, especially in that third quarter, just putting the little kicks in behind, forcing England to come back from deep.
And to that point, I mean, the ability to sort of fix things on the run, which seemed to be completely beyond England, and has been for Scotland on many occasions, but they really did do that on Saturday. You know, you saw Finn kind of huddling them up early on. I presume talking about this blitz defence, which we'd been going on, banging on about a length before the game, but
didn't really
see
it, did we?
That's it. They adjusted to it, and, you know, you started finding ways over it, under it, through it, rather than this, you know, always wanting to go wide, which, you know, they pulled off spectacularly on a couple of occasions, but there was a variety to Scotland and a clinical edge that just wasn't there with England. I mean, I think, you know, first three visits to England 22, they came away 17 points, which, you know, is pretty remarkable, really, and contrasts sharply with what we were seeing from England.
So if we widen this out, so firstly on the skill thing, that is quite alarming, isn't it? Major skill errors in a test match. So are they doing enough work on this in the week? That we get told by teams like Northampton and Bath, they touch the ball 100 times a session, always hands on the ball. And I remember being at Northampton when they've had breaks, and we talked with Jamie George on our pod about the break that's coming in the Premiership, and it actually weirdly does take you time to get back feeling the ball, which sounds odd for a professional rugby player, but they do so much ball work, skill all the time. At England, doing too much kicking and chasing and more defence in training and not enough actually playing with the ball.
I don't think they'd be doing too much kicking and chasing, because that's a lesser part of their game. It's still an important part of their game, but it's what's so bemusing about it. I mean, A, these are professional rugby players. Like, George Ford is one of the best distributors in the game. You know, his whole game is about making other players around him look better. And yet he was throwing passes that were too far in front of Ollie Lawrence and at George Furbank's face. Everything was off a beat. I don't believe that George Ford skimps on the work he has to do. So was it an anomaly? Just one of those days? They've got Kevin Sinfield, who's now skills coach, and they've had Andrew Strawbridge in camp.
Who's now gone home.
Who's gone home, but he was there for a month to work with Richard Wigglesworth and Kevin Sinfield on England's attacking skills. They've scored six tries so far, the Six Nations. And while they've looked, they've attacked with more purpose and more pace, and they've moved the ball better. They've scored six tries. In these same three fixtures last year, they scored 11 tries. Now, I wouldn't advocate England going back to only playing a kick pressure game, because I think it's limiting. And so I would want to give them time to evolve this, because you can. My feeling last year was the way that England played meant that their game was set by the quality of the opposition. So South Africa, the rain helped, but they played to a level that pushed the box to the limit. Samoa, Fiji, Argentina, all those games were tight. They were like less than a converted try in them. So I think that game was so limiting that they need to have a variety in how they play, so that the opposition don't know what's coming. You know, Scotland's first try is a great example of all eyes on Finn Russell, and he doesn't get the ball, and they're through. England need more variety in what they do in order to become more threatening, and that will take time. I think we have to appreciate that. But what I couldn't understand was why everything was off by a beat. All the timing was wrong, the execution was wrong, and you haven't seen England play like that before. So maybe, hopefully, it was just an aberration, but it is alarming.
So the next statistic that the players will tell you, which is absolutely factually correct, is that England had won 8 of the last 9 games and it's now 18-10. What is interesting, though, is that we've got to 19 tests in the Steve Borthwick era, and his victories have been 2 against Italy, 3 against Wales, 2 against Argentina, Japan, Samoa, Chile and Fiji. Yeah. And his defeats have been 2 times Scotland, 2 times Ireland, France, Wales, Fiji, South Africa. So, and he's only once beaten a team who'd been ranked above England in the rankings.
Yeah, that pool game of the World Cup.
And by beating Argentina, they dropped down like a stone to 10th because of other results on that weekend and everything else. So my question is, if a gun-for-hire head coach had come in to replace Eddie Jones and had a record of staring down the barrel of 2 from 5 Six Nations, a par, let's say, performance at the World Cup, which is worse than the one before, that's just a fact, would they be under more pressure?
Yeah, well, yes, they probably would. Mm. They probably would. I think that there's a sympathy for what Steve Borthwick inherited. I mean, we're going back away now, but he inherited a basket case of a team that wasn't functioning, and he just took a narrow route one approach to eke out as much as he could from that World Cup, which is why, as I said earlier, it was a standalone project. And now he's starting afresh. And this project is 2 wins and 1 ugly defeat. So if you look at it like that, it's not necessarily devastating. It's simply that there's an impatience from where England have been really since they won the title with some really ugly rugby in 2020. They won the title. Since then, there's just been building after building and not ever getting anywhere. So yeah, I think a big gun for hire coach would be under more pressure, but they would also have to recognise where England are. England have lost significant experience, big name players. I mean, Courtney would still be in this team now,
yeah,
playing
absolutely
at blindside flanker, and would make a huge difference. There's no question.
And Owen Farrell.
And Owen would definitely be playing too. So this is a new start. And it is one of those situations, however, where you can take the stats how you want them. Like they've had one significant win under Steve Borthwick, which was a statement win against Argentina first up, when they did think on their feet and they did react to adversity, and it was really impressive. And then the semi final was a defeat, but for an hour it was really impressive against the double world champions. But then you look at they've also shipped a record number of points at home to France. They suffered a first ever defeat by Fiji, who are a good team, but it was the first ever defeat by Fiji at home. And then Steve has overseen half of this run again in the Calcutta Cup, which hasn't happened for over 100 years.
Mm. And scraped Italy and scraped Wales.
I think there's a sympathy for him, which he needs to eke out as long as he can for the situation. But I do feel that he's up against it because the fixture list is unrelenting. They've got Ireland at home, who have a perfect record and galloping towards this Grand Slam. France might be a chance because they seem in all sorts of trouble at the moment. Japan against Eddie's new team, first up on tour, a chance. Then 3 consecutive tests against the All Blacks, bridging into November, and then South Africa. Like, you know, this is Bruce. When's he going to?
Test rugby.
It's Test rugby, absolutely. Yeah. I think perhaps what might end up being the hallmark of his regime is how he manages the evolution of this team up against the tough fixture list that he has. When does he settle on who his fly half is? And if it's Marcus Smith, if it's Finn Smith, when does he play him in this run of tough opponents? When does he bring in Chandler Cunningham South? When does he start Faye Wiboso? How does he manage that? If he can build this team through this challenging run of fixtures, and that could end up being one of the biggest achievements that he brings with England. But it's daunting, and he's starting still from rock bottom, and that's the problem. Long-winded answer here, but England don't feel any further. The context has changed, the situation has changed, but England still where they were a year ago, which is bumbling along in the lower reaches of the Six Nations.
And then, just to cap off this section, Ireland at Twickenham. And like before the tournament, I thought if there's possibly a team who could come up with a one-off game plan to beat Ireland, it's actually England. But the context changes every week in this tournament. And now you're looking at it going like, blimey, that could be as bad as the France one, 53-10. I mean, Scotland have got Ireland left too, and we'll get onto Ireland, but that looks a hell of a fixture to have next.
It does. I don't see either of those teams. I'm not going to say they won't trouble Ireland, but I don't see Ireland losing either of those teams or coming close to losing either of those games, frankly.
No. Okay, well, why don't we park our Scotland-England chat there and get on to the utter madness that was the end of the Italy-France match. But we'll have a little advert break first and get into that. Okay, so from the Doohan Sublime to the Lille Ridiculous. What a game that was, Mark, in the Pierre Mauroy. So just to talk it through for people who haven't quite fully caught up on a Monday morning yet. 13 all. Paolo Garbisi has a penalty with the last kick of the game to win for Italy's first away win in France ever. And he tees it up. Shot clock starts going. 30, 29, 28, 27. Ball falls off the tee. No idea how, because it's an indoor stadium with the roof closed. As John Westerly nicely put in his piece today, maybe all the French fans were blowing together. So ball falls off the tee. Everyone panics. The French come forward, which we'll get onto. He re-spots the ball with 8, 9, 7, 6 seconds left. Composes himself, take a breath, hits it left-footed, hits the post. Ball ends up coming out. Draw.
Simple
what on earth was that?
And Garbisi's defence, I mean, the conversion he just nailed to bring them level was an absolute beauty.
It was.
I was actually messaging him last night trying to get a reaction out of him about the
name drop.
About the circumstances of that penalty and the French charge or however you want to call it. He was being resolutely diplomatic about it, but you know, it did look like it probably should have been re-spotted. And you know, with that, who knows?
I was watching it thinking if Wayne Barnes was the ref here, he would have just, I always go back to that France Wales game a few years back when
the 100 minute game
where he managed that scrum chaos and France gaming the system and all that, just managed it perfectly because he's got just applied his legal brain to it. And I just thought there that if Wayne Barnes had been in charge, he'd have known what to do immediately. The procedure, the protocols would have just kicked in. Because earlier in the day, early on Saturday, over in Ireland, there was a moment when the shot clock had started for penalty and the penalty spot got moved, so the ref just turned the shot clock off. That's what should happen. Once that ball fell over, not because it fell over, but because the others had advanced, the shot clock should have gone off, I think, and he should have been able to retake it. And you know, the what ifs here, but France could be naught from the three.
I know.
If it wasn't for referees and protocols, you know, Scotland were denied that win against them up here at Murrayfield, and now they've kind of got away with a draw. You know, I think that the shot clock is proving to work. Like, I think it's, if anything, it should be shorter, it should be quicker. But what a great performance from Italy to even get that far. I mean, I was thinking, like John Westerby was there, And I was thinking, it's one of those games where you're filing just behind the fourth wall, if you like. You're writing through the game with these matches to do an on the whistle report, and then this happens, and like pretty much the top half of what you've just written for over 80 minutes
in the bin
has gone because this is the story. But it shouldn't be the only focus, I don't think, because of the way that Italy came back into it and maybe took advantage of Donti being sent off is worthy of praise as well.
Just because we've mentioned the kicking thing, so let's just briefly read you a couple of world rugby laws. So if the kicker indicates to the referee the intent is to kick a goal, the opposing team must stand still with their hands by their sides from the time the kicker starts to approach the kick until the ball is kicked. So there was the moment when the ball fell off and the French players come and advance, and even there's a water boy on there as well, and then don't retreat. So then what should have happened is the next bit of the law, if the opposing team infringes while the kick is being taken, but the kick at the goal is successful, the goal stands, and a further penalty is not awarded. If the kick is unsuccessful, so this scenario, the non-offending team is awarded a penalty 10 metres in front of the original mark. So the Wayne Barnes of this world should have known their law book and said, look, you've advanced the penalty, you shouldn't have been able to do that. Let's re-spot the ball 10 metres further on, and they would have had their chance. And he couldn't have missed from there. But anyway, so we've done the kick. I think one of us might have said, I can't remember who it was, so I'm not trying to be all false humble if it was me, but there is a win in this Italy team somewhere, and they should have had one. But that was, and we know that France have seriously dipped, but that was a really amazing effort from them.
It was, and I think we'd seen in their first couple of games, well, certainly the England game, a real kind of queer impression of what the game that Gonzalo Quezada's trying to have them put out there. And, you know, that was the queerest expression of it yet in terms of the ability to kind of show variety, you know, from the Kieran Crowley days of running it from everywhere. They still got that in them, as they showed with Capozzi's try and the performance of Menoncello on the wing. But there's a lot more control to them now. And, you know, that forward pack he's rekindled some of those traditional values. Giuliani was excellent over ball yesterday, winning the turnovers. They feel more substantial now. And, you know, they've Scotland at home, then go to Cardiff, seen of that great win in 2022. They will feel that there's still something tangible for them to claim this championship.
Yeah, and absolutely. The night before.
Exactly.
Their under-20s beat France.
Away from home.
You know, there is almost the opposite to Scotland. There's the success under 20s level in Italy, which gives real hope that there's something building, and that there is more than, you know, in a year, a few years' time, there'll be more than just maybe a win in Italy, that, you know, maybe there'll be a couple of wins, and there seems to be a bit of depth within Italian rugby.
And I think, you know, they're starting to see the fruits of some of the building blocks that are put in place, probably as far back as our own Franco Smith, who's now here at Glasgow Warriors in Scotland, who was kind of their high performance director. And when he was in charge of the national team, gave a lot of these guys their caps, probably, you know, from what was seen from the outside, too early a stage, but they've now got 2-3 years of international rugby under their belt. You can see that there's been a real adaptation there. And I think, as I say, under a coach with a slightly more pragmatic game plan, you can see it coming to the boil. And with those players coming through the system, getting more exposure in better Benetton and Zebre teams as well, that's an important point. You know, that it does feel that there's a momentum there now.
And like the opposite of Scotland, in that they're picking up, you know, Adogru is injured at the moment, but Paolo Adogru is there. Louis Lyon has just signed for Italian rugby, effectively.
Matt Gallagher.
But they also have a pathway that seems to be working, and if you can strike that balance, it's really
heartening, isn't it? Like, it wasn't good that they were losing all those games for anyone. Not good for Italian rugby, not good for Six Nations, not good for the endless stories. Like, there should be more of a meritocracy, but it's just so much better that Italy are properly competing now, isn't it?
Can you imagine how amazing it would be? Sorry, are you about to answer that question? We referred to the England-Argentina World Cup game, and, you know, when the Pumas, that Latin passion for their sport, when the Pumas are playing and the Pumas fans in the stands are jumping and singing, imagine what Stadio Olimpico would be like for a day when, you know, when they can, England can go and they can beat England, and the place would be
properly hostile.
Rocking. It'd be fantastic.
Give it a couple of weeks, mate. But I believe they're up to just about 70,000 tickets for that game already for Scotland. And, you know, again, buoyed by that performance, you've got to imagine that it will shift a few more. You know, it's not a huge leap of the imagination to think of that game being close. And, you know, Italy will feel they've got a right good chance now as well. So, yeah, it could be an interesting weekend.
That would, I mean, like, not to tell you this, Mark, but that would be so Scotland, wouldn't it?
100%.
To go and lose in Italy.
And then beat Ireland.
Yeah. But, right, so should we do 2 minutes on France? Because they're almost becoming the story of the Six Nations, yeah. Aren't they? This utter collapse. I mean, what on earth is going on there? I mean, do we know? I mean, it's not getting rid of that ball at the end. I mean, obviously they were trying to score. And there was that bit in the Netflix series of, like, Don... I won't attempt the Wigan Frongley. Just kick the ball off the field, guys. But what is going on there?
Well, I guess on Saturday and Sunday in particular, they had Jonathan Danti sent off and Jalibert went off. So those circumstances don't help you. But I think, you know, and obviously Dupont, the best player is not there. But I...
Got into the semis of the sevens.
Yeah. He looks amazingly good at that already. Dupont, just a wonderful rugby player. But I think maybe because language barrier, and perhaps we haven't focused enough on how many changes happened behind the scenes with France, and so many of the key coaches left after the World Cup to go into club rugby, and you know, and Rafael Ibanez has had his role changed. I think he was really important. So at the moment they've got Galtier still there and Sean Edwards still there, but the rest has changed, and I think the dynamic in the camp has changed. A lot of what you hear is that the assistant coaches were doing a lot of the coaching and a lot of the communicating with the players, and now that has shifted and Galtier is a bit more hands on with the players, and so there's been a lot of change behind the scenes that perhaps we haven't sort of reflected well enough, because I think that looks to me like it's been key, because the mindset of the team seems so different.
It does, and it's surely too simplistic to put it down to a kind of post-World Cup fug, because, you know, we're now three games into the Six Nations, so, and, you know, they were error-strewn and disappointing at Murrayfield. Obviously, the first game was a disaster, and then, you know, not much better yesterday, so... Yeah, there's not many signs of life, really, which is surprising.
I can understand that the World Cup would have knocked stuffing out of them. Mm. You know, it was so big, such a big event, and such an enormous disappointment to go out the stage they did. But that's coaching. Coaching is you use that.
Yeah, that's fuel.
That becomes a, like, we've got a point. Let's not be measured by that. Let's be measured by the team that won the Slam. Let's go do that again. You know, Ireland are in the same boat. They've had a lot less disruption, and they've got a player in Jack Crowley who's just stepped in and picked up where Johnny Sexton left off and is playing beautifully from outside of the Leinster bubble and has slotted in perfectly. But they've had a lot less disruption. They've just used that setback as in exactly the right way, and they are miles ahead.
Yeah, they've gone to another level again, haven't they?
Of everyone else.
Yeah. Well, why don't we do a bit of Ireland Wales after another little break? But yeah, there's already been talk that if France don't win another game in the Six Nations, that Galtier could be gone, which is extraordinary, isn't it? Like Bernard Jackman, friend of our pod, who was on it last week, was saying that, like, there's already mood music in France that he could lose his job at the end of the tournament if it's not a good one, which it would be an unbelievable story. But
well, all we need is a player revolt just for the whole kind of thing to be perfectly French.
Yeah, wow. So right, okay, let's have a little break and then we'll go into a bit of Ireland Wales.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, Ireland, Wales, 31-7. Really routine for Ireland. 3 from 3. I suppose the question now is, how do they mess it up from here? Really? We talked about the England game, but
I don't think they messed it up from
cruising.
Here. I think that they are a well-oiled groove machine. No.
Sounds like
sorry.
The 90s sort of...
It was. Band, I suddenly got the Wonder Stuff album in my head. Eight-legged groove machine. Anyway, I'm going to go with it. They're the modern... If the Wonder Stuff released their album now, they'd call it the well-oiled groove machine of Irish rugby.
Andy Farrell and the group machine.
They are the one, aren't they? They're like, they don't mess it up from here. They are, I'm not sure there have been many Six Nations, maybe back when England were dominant, where there's such a gap between them and everyone else.
But there wasn't, because England would lose one of those games, invariably.
There was a, year when England did the slam.
03.
Yeah.
That was the most wide points difference slam, if that makes sense. As in, they beat everyone convincingly.
Yeah, so there you go. There's been 20 championships since then.
Yeah.
But to
cruise to a double slam.
Yeah.
Feels like we should note that. We're two games away from it, but that would be utterly extraordinary, wasn't
been,
it?
I was looking at it. So there have been 20 championships since England won the World Cup. So I was looking at it through an England perspective, but there have been 11 slams in those 20 years. England have won one of them. It happens roughly once every 2 years, but not for the same team.
Yeah.
Wales have won 4 in that period, so it's incredibly difficult feat to win a slam, to go back to back slams, and to do it so easily.
It's an obvious point to make, but it's beating everyone at home. And then having a whole year and then beating everyone away. That's just so remarkable.
It is. And, as I think we talked about Bernard last week when he was mentioning his pal on the Italian coaching team who just couldn't identify a single weakness in the prep. You're sitting there going, I'm sure they maybe did, or potential areas, then we're not able to exploit any of them. But, there isn't an obvious chink in the armour. They're just such a good site. There's so many layers to it and different ways that they can go, And I think they've gone to another level in that power game in this Six Nations, so that you're now, what was a two-division Six Nations with Ireland and France and the rest is now very much Ireland and the rest. So
yeah. I mean, they're in this dream situation that the All Blacks, where they're settled and they know who they are and they know what they do, so you can drop in a new player and they just... that they're carried, are swept along by what's around them, and I know that doesn't quite work as the 10 because you're the guy who's running the show. But Jack Crowley's benefited from dropping into a team that is functioning and understands itself. McCarthy has just added something second row wise, like what a beast he is. I think it's just we were having one of those kind of Lions conversations as you do over dinner on Saturday night. It's like, wow, McCarthy, if George Martin can be fit, like there's some.
How many non-Ireland players get in there? 50?
Hardly.
There'd be some Scots, though, on current form, wouldn't there?
A couple, but geez, it's...
Duane would probably get in.
Finn?
Well, it depends when you pick it. Is it that? I mean, anyway, let's not go down this.
Yeah.
But, Crowley, I guess my point is they can... They've had a couple of changes since injuries and whatever and retirement since the World Cup, but they can just... They're so settled and they're so sure of their identity and how they play and who they are that you can drop a new player in and they just flourish. And where England are is they're dropping new players into a system that no one yet understands.
Mm. And where Wales are is they're dropping a whole team together.
Yeah.
And then, like, weirdly,
yeah,
the 0 from 3 and everything you read and write and hear about Wales is like, oh, not bad. Which is such an odd... It's all context is king in the Six Nations, isn't it? But
yeah, so that game, like, at half-time, before the game, we were watching at Murrayfield, and I looked at the odds, and we'd have a chat about... And Wales were 14-1 to win that game. And I never thought they'd win the game, but 14-1, I was like...
Incredible.
So I put a couple of quid on it, just for, like, one, in case one of those, like, lightning bolt days happens. And then at halftime, it's like it's one way traffic, and I think my winnings would have been 75 quid if Wales had won. They're offering me 84p to cash out at halftime, so for comedy value, I cashed out halftime and took my 84p back. And then Wales went and scored, and I was like, this could be one of the great stories for Wales, and also one of the like worst days. But they didn't quite have enough to get over the line. But in the...
Gamble responsibly, by the way.
Yeah.
When the fun stop.
In the Scotland game, they were way off the pace for the first half and then came storming back, as we know. They were way off the pace again and then got themselves together. And if just from a Wales perspective, I would be looking at those two second halves as evidence of what does exist within that team. And they were so young. Some of the players walk off, and you're like, wow, are they...
It's like that Liverpool team.
Should have been playing in the under-20s game last night. I mean, a lot of them could have been. I mean, the context is very different. Gatland will get them... He'll forge them into something over the course of 12 months. I'm sure he will.
And here's a theory. Wales end the Six Nations with the same record as England. Beat France at home next week. France in the gutter. And then they go and win the death match against Italy. 2 from 5, not bad.
Yeah, I can see that.
Context is king.
I can see that.
Funny.
That is feasible.
So there you go. Right, that's been our rattle through the three fixtures over the weekend. So we will do a bit of Goddess of the Week, and we might delve into one email as well, because we've got an email. Someone's emailed us. Amazing. But we'll do that after this. Okay, so as we mentioned, we one of you has emailed us, which is just brilliant. theruck@thetimes.co.uk, and we did sort of touch on it briefly, but we've got Craig's emailed us. He said, "I've got a question for your pod. Does World Rugby have an issue with referees? Scotland, France, obvious. Italy on the final whistle. Wales, Ireland had an issue with Wales getting pinged for a squint feed, and then Ireland didn't. World Cup was plagued with bad decisions." So we did touch on it. But is there a little... Some of the most senior refs are not doing lots of these games. I don't know. Is there an issue of refereeing we're having here? We don't want to go too deep on them.
Not an issue as in like a conspiracy.
Yeah, yeah.
I think first Six Nations after a World Cup, the referees manager will look at it in the same way as all the coaches are looking at it. That this is, you know, there's another 4-year cycle. They need to get the younger referees game time, frankly.
I quite like the idea of Joel Jute doing a press conference where going like, oh, it's a 4-year cycle,
just, we're
guys.
Building.
Just pray for patience.
We're just building. Judge us on the next World
Cup.
Judge
us at 27.
But it's a similar approach. It's a similar approach. I would have... Some of the appointments are not what you might have expected. I think, obviously Wayne Barnes isn't around to do games now, but I think they could have had some bigger names, more established referees doing some of the bigger fixtures. When you don't, you're going to get some inconsistency or some errors. I don't think Craig Scottish. He's probably feeling a bit miffed.
Scottish, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it's a conspiracy, but they've definitely... I'd be interested to see who gets rugby championship games, because if they get all the number ones, then I think maybe we do have a problem. But if the appointments are consistent through Six Nations and Rugby Championship, then I think we have to understand that we need to be bringing through as many good referees as we can.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, why don't we clean up and leave out?
Well, thanks for your email, Craig.
Yeah, thank you, Craig. Yeah, and if anyone else wants to email, theruck@thetimes.co.uk or use your places. Let's do some gods, goddesses, devils. Are you going to go with with your man?
Who's getting in first? Yeah. Who's getting in first to pick Duhan?
I'm going to grab Duhan now. sitting in the Scottish capital, I'm calling dibs. Yeah, a very obvious one, but, you know, a history maker in the strictest sense of the term. He's individually 4 from 4 against England, so clearly the difference maker.
5 tries in 2 games against England.
Yeah, and 6 over the piece because he scored the only try in the COVID win at Twickenham as well. So it's just a remarkable record, truly. So,
and his average distance of scoring those tries will be pretty impressive,
massive,
too.
Massive, yeah.
And we should point out, he's only one short of Stuart Hogg's record now as well.
Already?
So, yeah, he's on 26 in 37, I think it is.
And Hogg got 100 caps on the nose, didn't he?
Exactly. So, you could have Doohan going past that easily in under 40 caps. So, yeah, quite the prospect.
That is incredible, isn't it? Okay. Alex, God, Goddess, something else?
So, one of the things I enjoyed the most last week was watching the Wallabies documentary. Now, there have been a lot of rugby documentaries out recently. The Whistleblowers one on the referees is worth a watch. That's that film through the World Cup. That's really good. But the Wallabies one is, if you can find a way of watching it, I've managed to watch all 3 episodes. It is really good. Follows them from Eddie joining as head coach through to the end of the World Cup. And it is, you may have seen some clips floating around social. It's car crash TV at times. They obviously slightly, put it this way, they don't interview the Sydney Morning Herald journalist, Tom Decent, who broke the story about Eddie joining Japan. So, which he's already put out there. But it doesn't take away, because you know what's happening, it doesn't really take away anything. It's good. It's raw, actually. And by all accounts, there's a lot that had to come out. Not that Rugby Australia took out, but the producers were like, we can't. It sounds like it was pretty crazy days behind the scenes. So, I'm just going to nominate the makers of that, because if you get a chance to watch it, you should. It's good.
Okay. Good nomination. Good, a little bit left field, but we like it. That's good. Mine's going to be straight up and down as he played, I suppose, on the weekend. Caelan Doris, who's probably in your World 15. I can't believe that a certain Ruck podcast didn't put any Irishman in their team of 2023, which is just outrageous. And I feel like it should be cancelled immediately, but we'll make up for it, by picking Caelan Doris this week, because he was awesome. And he, you would expect, will enjoy a pretty decent day at Twickenham too. He's become an unbelievable back row, hasn't he?
Quality.
It's very early for our Lions chat, but he looks like a name. And unless he's injured, he's certainly in the plane and almost certainly in the back rows.
Yeah, and I'd like to know more about him. One of the great frustrations of covering rugby is Ireland are so
closed off
from telling their own stories, that he's a really interesting, intelligent, articulate guy, and I'd love to know more about him. I think he could grow into one of the great players of the era. I just wish they'd open the doors up a little bit more and let people realise what a special guy he is, never mind what a good player he is.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, that has been our Week 3 moving week ruck. We've done it. We're through. We've got a couple of rounds to go. Fallow week. What's everyone up to? Apart from just trying to get home. It's a bit of train chaos for us, which you're all going to be so sympathetic to us for.
England are training in York.
In York, yeah. That's good of them.
It's on the same line, Alex. You can just stop off.
Same, yeah. Outreach. They're there Thursday, Friday, I think. So a bit of outreach from them. In the north, it's a stadium. They're training at the same stadium which is being used for the Women's World Cup next year, which is I think part of it. But so we'll probably end up going to York for a day or two. Otherwise, we'll just sit.
Mark's just chilling out, sunny Edinburgh.
Most of these fallow weeks, because they're not going to be around for long. Or at least one of them won't.
Yeah, true.
They're being ditched from 2026, so there'll only be one fallow week from them.
No Scotland access for us this week, so we're going to need to make our own fun.
Staggering.
Nothing.
That is outrageously bad. I mean,
wow. Even Netflix, who are paying for access, struggles, but that is remarkable that they could be on for a title, possibly, and they don't want to speak to the media. But there you go. One for another day. But thank you, everyone, for listening to our Ruck this week. We'll be back next Monday. We'll be back every Monday, as always. But for now, we'll say thank you to Mark for hosting us in a lovely country and putting the sun on for us and then beating the England team.
Always a pleasure.
And Alex, safe journey home, mate. And thank you all for listening. If you wanted to email, obviously, theruck@thetimes.co.uk. But otherwise, follow, subscribe, tell all your friends, and tune in next week. But for now, see you later.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.